Baptist's Head, a special two-part episode in which Duncan talks about his ongoing work with the Holy Guardian Angel. Part 2, Conversion and Reconversion.
I haven't listened to the earlier segments that I recorded, but that all seems a very long time ago now. And it all seems done and dusted. The problems that I went in with concerning my meditation were cleared up in the first couple of days, really. Very simple, real embarrassing to talk about, almost. Basically, I was craving for mystical states, which I'd experienced. And of course, craving for them is a surefire way of making sure that they don't happen. Another issue, which was that the sort of concentration I was doing, I realised wasn't subtle enough. I often do meditation which involves concentrating on the breath, and to do that successfully you really have to focus your concentration down to a very small point. You concentrate on the sensation of the breath as it hits the nostrils on the way in and as it hits the upper lip on the way out, and it's the smallness of the area, the tightness of the concentration that demands, which gets your mind into those focus states. And basically what I was doing was my focus was just too wide, too blurry. I was using the retreat to kick start a new phase in my Holy Guardian Angel working. What I imagined beforehand was that I would go on to the retreat, I would clear up the problems with my meditation, and the meditation would then become a vehicle for me to get closer to the HGA. But something entirely unexpected happened instead. Looking back, perhaps I should have expected it, and perhaps it was really a little disingenuous of me, to say the least, to think to myself that I could go in and genuinely set aside all my magical practices and focus purely on the meditation, although that was the intention that I had. Well, the retreat itself was a Vipassana meditation retreat, and it was quite intensive stuff. The first 3 days, they kicked us off doing not Vipassana at all, but a Samatha technique, the concentrating on the breathing meditation. And we did that continuously for 3 days. On the second day, I had a breakthrough. It was the last session in the evening, and I was sitting on the cushion, and I was desperate for the toilet, and my back hurt, and I wanted to sneeze, but I didn't want to disturb anyone, so I stifled the sneeze. And because I'd stifled the sneeze, my nose had started to run, so there was snot dribbling out my nose and down my chin. And even though I was in extreme discomfort, I managed to focus very intensely on the breath and dropped into a dhyana state, not particularly high, I don't think. But I hadn't experienced anything like that for a very long time. And the thing about this state wasn't how deep it was just that it lasted for a very, very long time. I was able to ride it for 20 or 30 minutes, which for me is the longest by far that I've been able to keep up a concentrated state. And I was feeling really high at that point. I was thinking, excellent, I'm going to get 10 days of surfing the formless realms. Didn't quite work out like that in the end. After we'd done 3 days of breathing meditation, they moved us on to this weird phase where what we did was we simply concentrated on sensations in our upper lip. I think we did that for about a day and a half or a couple of days, just kind of concentrating on this very small area of our bodies. And then the Vipassana training in earnest kicked off. Basically, we ended up learning a technique which enabled us to scan our bodies very minutely and thoroughly with our minds. The idea behind it was that every part of the body is subject to sensations at every single moment. It's just that we're not aware of most of them. So what we were doing was taking our minds to every part of ourselves and feeling these small, subtle sensations that you don't ordinarily notice. They feel like kind of electrical tickling or prickling in my case, although I think probably various people experience them in various ways. Sometimes they feel to me like coldness on the skin, like a kind of cold breeze. What the Vipassana technique we learned involved, it was taking the mind all over the body, sweeping the body, feeling all these subtle sensations everywhere that they occurred, and also being on the lookout for gross sensations as well, which are in contrast to the subtle sensations. These might be areas of pain or tension in the body, or they might just be areas that are experiencing pressure or sensations that kind of push through that barrier of conscious awareness, like your bum on the cushion or your knees on the floor, a sensation that is immediately available to consciousness. And these areas are more difficult to sweep. You can't sweep your mind through them the way you can sweep your mind through parts of the body that only have subtle sensations in them. Now, the Vipassana technique involves continually scanning your body, defining the areas that are experiencing subtle sensations, defining the areas that are experiencing gross sensations. And then what you do is you just feel the body as it is. You just dwell in the present moment, aware of the feelings in your body as they are currently occurring, not as you want them to be, not ignoring areas of pain or strong sensation, just accepting your body for what it is. And as far as possible, you experience your body very much on the sensational level, not regarding it as yours or you or identifying with the sensations at all. This was the part that I actually found most difficult. There was only one instance in which I really seemed to get to grips with the technique when I was actually sitting meditating in my room. I'm feeling a bit disappointed with the technique because, as I saw it at the time, because the mind was moving around and looking at different parts in the body and not staying in one place, it wasn't getting into the lovely, nice, focused state that I'd experienced with the breathing meditation. And I was thinking to myself, you know, maybe it's just a contemplative exercise, maybe it's not going to really take us anywhere interesting, this technique. But then I sat, and after only a couple of minutes, suddenly my body dissolved away completely. There were just these rushing, tingling, prickling, cold sensations that I talked about earlier. That's all I was, just a mass of these sensations that were pulsating away in a kind of quantum flux. There was no I there at all. There was just these sensations. And also, something that I've never experienced before, beneath all this, a rather enticing but strange sense of something else. Something that was very still and whole, and in contrast to the rushing flux of sensations that were me, something that didn't move, something that was always there, something that was aware, that I'd never ever come close to before. But this realization lasted only for a few seconds, and idiot that I am, as soon as I reached this realization, experienced all this stuff, part of me just recoiled and stood back and was possessed by a desperate need to actually step away from the experience in order to think about it. It was like this thing happened, and immediately I was thinking to myself, oh, I really need to sit down and think about this. And of course, when that thought overtook me, I stopped meditating and just dropped out the thing entirely, and for the rest of the retreat never got anywhere near it again. Now, things started to go a bit bizarre. A few days after this, we learnt the Vipassana technique, and then we concentrated during the remaining days on establishing ourselves in that technique, really putting in some hours and building up some degree of expertise behind it. And I was quite serious about the work and dedicated to it. But at the same time, I was confronting quite a few challenges from my body. I was really glad for all the yoga I've been doing when I went in there, although I was starting to get problems in my back. But the thing that was bothering me most of all was that I was suffering really quite badly from constipation. As soon as I went in there, my body seemed to notice and react quite strongly to the new regime. I got the impression that it was saying, look, you're not doing any exercise, you're not putting any food in me, or you're not putting as much food in me as you usually do, so I'm shutting down. And shut down it truly did. But I think it was on about the fourth or fifth night that I had quite a vivid dream. My dreams went wild during the retreat. Dreams were like fireworks every single night. But there was this one dream that stuck in my mind, although it's pretty nonsensical. And the dream was just a kind of snippet, really. It was the idea that there was a woman who, on the edge of town, had started a business. And the business was a waste disposal company. And the name of the waste disposal company was A-In Waste Disposal Company. And I was standing outside the headquarters of this place and reading the sign and thinking to myself, that's a weird name, A-In. It's weird because I can't break it down into anything else. I can't see where that name has been derived from. I think it was almost a lucid dream, because towards the end I remember almost becoming aware that this was a dream and that there seemed to be some kind of message in it. And I think I would almost remembered at that point that Ayin is, of course, a Hebrew letter, a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And as I woke up, I seemed to hear a voice, and the voice said to me very quickly, very loudly, "Stop trying." That was the message, "Stop trying." And there was just something a bit strange about this dream, although it was sort of fairly typical for a dream, I think, just a kind of vague snippet. But there was something powerful about it, whether it was the voice, I'm not sure. But it kept coming back into my mind. And to begin with, I wondered whether it was a message from my unconscious regarding the constipation, telling me not to get too worried and not to keep trying to fight against it, which I was certainly doing at the time, and just told me to stop trying. And to test this out, I did stop trying, and as far as the constipation was concerned, it did seem to have a little bit of success after that point. But anyway, this dream stayed with me throughout the week, and it was quite frustrating because you weren't allowed to read, you weren't allowed any books or writing materials or access to the internet, so I couldn't actually look up what Ayin meant, because as a Hebrew letter I knew that it would have a symbolism behind it, it would have a number, it would also designate a path on the Tree of Life, and it would also have a tarot trump associated with it. But I knew I wasn't going to find out what those were until I got out. On the eighth day, I started to wobble with the technique. To begin with, it seemed as if I'd plateaued. I'd established the technique, got it down pretty well, was making good progress with it. But I realised I kind of reached a point where I wasn't really going to get much further for quite some time. I wasn't going to have any more amazing experiences. I could just tell, I could just tell I was at that point where I was going to settle into the technique and just keep going at the same level for a while. So I started to get a little bit bored, but then something cropped up which renewed my interest, kept me going for another day. But the doubt never really quite went away, the discontent never really quite went away. And then suddenly on the ninth day, the bottom dropped out of the whole experience. And I found myself in a very desolate place where I just didn't trust it anymore and it meant nothing to me. The retreat centre that I went to was one of various other ones around the world, which are run by a guy called S.N. Goenka, Burmese businessman, who converted to Buddhism after someone had recommended Vipassana meditation to him as a cure for very severe migraines that no doctor had been able to alleviate. Doing the Vipassana meditation sorted these migraines out, and it seems as if Mr. Goenka then took it upon himself to make it his mission to export Vipassana meditation to the whole world. And good for him, in my opinion. But I was starting to find the whole experience a little disconcerting. The course was taught by watching videos of Mr. Goenka and audio recordings, although there was an assistant teacher there who you could consult. But all the proceedings were very much dominated by Mr. Goenka's personality. And I got tired of him trying to hypnotise me all the time. He has this very kind of slow, deliberate style of delivery in his lectures about the technique, and he repeats the same phrases over and over. And half the time, you know exactly what he's going to say. So you're being put in a very passive position where you know what he's going to say, but you have to sit there and listen. And it's as if in order to get down the technique, you have to very much subject yourself to him, to Mr. Goenka. As well as the fact that in the meditation hall, they used this speaker system where you couldn't see any speakers, and the sound seemed to come from everywhere, so it was as if Goenka's voice was continually inside your head. Now, I don't think there's anything sort of too creepy or untoward going on in these centres. I think they're genuine, absolutely genuine. But I was starting to feel as if my mind was being fucked with a little bit. And also the silence, the vow of silence that we'd taken, although I could see the point of it and thought it was really great, how, because you weren't allowed to speak, you couldn't taint other people's experience of the meditation and they couldn't taint yours. Even so, it was a very constricting and controlling mechanism because it also silenced debate and criticism as well. Not that you particularly want that on a retreat, but there you go, that's how it made me feel. The other thing I was having problems with was a theoretical thing. In the talks, they kept presenting this concept of sankharas. According to the lectures, a sankhara is a reaction to a sensation, either of aversion or craving, which can then predispose you to a habit. In other words, if a sensation appears on the body, and instead of treating it as something impermanent, which has no essence, which, if you're a proficient Buddhist, you would be inclined to do, if you fail to do that, then a sankhara results. If you have an unpleasant feeling and you respond by flinching away or recoiling from the unpleasantness of the pain, or if you have a pleasant experience and you start to chase after it or anticipate it, then these are sankharas, these are reactions that are predisposing you to a habit, and they're taking you away from the equanimous state of mind that is the aim of the meditation to maintain. Once the balance of your mind is upset, then you're back in the realm of suffering. So part of the Vipassana technique was about being aware of the pleasant and unpleasant sensations you're experiencing in your body as you sat on the mat meditating, and about maintaining an equanimous attitude toward them. There was a growing emphasis as the course went on maintaining your position and sitting still for the whole hour that you were sitting. And after a while, naturally, any position you'd adopted would start to feel uncomfortable. But as Mr. Goenka pointed out, no more new sankharas. We're expected to sit and tolerate the pain, use the technique itself to make the pain easier to bear, and get through to the end of the hour with our equanimity intact. I found this difficult to swallow. This whole idea of sankharas, the way it was being treated, just felt a bit wrong to me. It started to feel like a Buddhist substitute for the idea of sin. You know, if you don't maintain your equanimity, if you don't keep up a good neutral attitude, you'll get a sankhara. You will get a sankhara. And that's what you'll have deserved. I don't know. That's what I started to feel anyway. And once I'd started to perceive it in this way, the whole technique started to feel like it was just based on endurance, as if we were sitting on the cushion, feeling uncomfortable, pretending to ourselves that we didn't feel uncomfortable, and then assuming that if we pretended successfully that we didn't feel uncomfortable, then we were somehow making ourselves better people, which prompted me to start experimenting. I sat a couple of sessions where I didn't do the technique. I just basically sat for an hour and use my willpower not to react to the pain. And even though I wasn't using the technique, I didn't find it any easier to tolerate the discomfort. And also at the end, I didn't feel any less good. And that really was when it all collapsed and the balance swung for me. Because I was in the process of thinking that maybe I was more of a Buddhist than a magician. Because the stuff we were doing, the talks we were listening to in the evening, they seemed so much more serious than the magical work that I've been doing. The magical work with all the uncertainties and vagueness and difficulties that you try to get to grips with, always trying to ascertain what's going on, as compared with this incredibly simple, incredibly clear Dharma with a very coherent goal at the end, goal of enlightenment. You know, the Buddhism seemed very much to be focused upon the goal of personal salvation, and was starting to seem as if it was a lot more likely to deliver than the occult stuff I've been doing. Put me in a really bad state, easily as bad as the other states I was talking about in the first half of this recording. I started thinking about the dream again, and the voice I'd heard saying, stop trying, and picked myself up, went back to the meditation hall in the afternoon, and decided to follow that instruction. Sat down, the session started, so I stopped trying. I stopped doing anything, stopped doing the technique, stopped trying to meditate, stopped trying to concentrate, stopped trying to work out intellectually all the debates that were going around in my head. And immediately I went into a trance state, not particularly deep, but significant, which was totally unexpected. And in this trance state, I suddenly had the idea that I must go to the woods and invoke the Holy Guardian Angel, that the dream was from the Holy Guardian Angel, and the only way I could be sure that was the case was to go to the woods, summon him, and ask him face to face. Initially, the idea came to me that I should go to the woods, strip naked, roll around in the mud, and then invoke. But I kind of thought to myself that that was maybe not a good idea, because it was pretty wild, the weather, and would probably result in pneumonia or maybe even being detained under the Mental Health Act if anyone saw me. So I decided that sneaking off during a session when I was supposed to be meditating was extreme enough. That's what I did. I went to the woods, aware that I was breaking my vow to cast off all my magical practice and stick to the technique. But I figured that if I was right, that if this was a message from the angel, then that was what I needed to be doing. So it was an act of faith on my part. So I went to the woods, and very windy, there's a gale blowing, it's raining as well. Made sure no one saw me, made sure there was no one in the vicinity. Banished in the woods, and invoked, asked the angel to appear. And as soon as the invocation had come out of my mouth, there was a thwack. And I looked up, and a blackbird had come down on the fence, right in front of me, and was staring at me. And one of the attributes of the angel that I've managed to amass so far is it's bird-like. It's also blue, but you don't get that many blue species of birds in English woods, so maybe a blackbird was the nearest thing. But this bird just kind of sat there on the fence post right in front of me, staring at me. It didn't fly away, it sort of edged into the undergrowth, was staring at me the whole time, so sort of addressed myself in its general direction and talked to the angel, explained what had been going on, why I'd invoked him, talking about what had been going through my mind. And it seemed to help. It felt right. I felt as if I had done the right thing, that the message was from the angel, although at that point I still didn't know what it meant. Maybe it was simply the process of verbalising what was going on in my mind in that wood, but it suddenly put into perspective for me what was actually going on at that moment. But I think what that ritual actually achieved for me was it brought home the fact that first and foremost I am a magician and not a Buddhist. Because what had happened was when I had that experience, when I was meditating and my body dissolved and I saw myself as a quantum flux of sensations, that was true, that was reality. But then at the same time, when the technique collapsed for me and it seemed just an exercise in tolerating having a sore bum, that was reality too. I think at that point the whole idea of Buddhism and following the Dharma went out the window, because it brought home the fact that you make your own Dharma, that reality is wherever your belief goes. And first and foremost, I was a magician. The thing with the bird was quite strange. The wood, well, not really a wood, more a sort of very small wood, copse, spinny, was on the grounds of the retreat centre, and you were encouraged to walk there during exercise periods. And the next day I was walking through and heard a thwack and was looking around at one point because I thought someone was having a joke and was throwing stuff at me. Couldn't see anything. Then as I left the wood, I heard it again, this thwacking noise, and turned round, and yet again a blackbird, probably the same one, had landed on the ground and was staring up at me. I'd just left the wood and it was inside staring up at me from the leaves on the floor. And it felt as if I was kind of being reminded, you know, don't forget what happened yesterday. So anyway, I've come away with a lot of stuff from the retreat. I cleared up my difficulties with meditation. I've got a new meditation technique. And then there was this rather traumatic conversion and reconversion process where I thought I was ceasing to be a magician and becoming a Buddhist. But then the angel put in an appearance and I realised that I am first and foremost a magician, and that Buddhism for me is just a set of techniques that I dip into and out of. And then there was the dream, because I got back home, was finally able to look up what Ayin means. And it's the aspect of it as a path on the Tree of Life, which seems most significant, and seems to offer most as a pointer towards what the next phase in this work will be. Because Ayin is the path that leads from Hod to Tifereth. Tifereth is the place where the Holy Guardian Angel resides on the Tree of Life. It sort of is the Holy Guardian Angel, in a way. And Hod is very much where I feel I am most of the time. I mean, I am a person who's dominated mostly by rationality, intellect, verbal reasoning. When I was talking earlier about how I had that meditative experience and felt as if I needed to kind of step back and withdraw and reflect upon it, that's kind of very typical of me. And I'm very aware that I often let ideas get in the way of me experiencing things, and have done a lot of work to get around that but there is obviously more work to do. This path on the Tree of Life, Aeon, that goes from Hod to Tifereth, is all about casting off old ways of being, old habits of thinking, casting off the thinking process itself as a means of arriving at Tifereth. The tarot trump associated with the path is the Devil, which is about fixity and entrapment in old forms, old ways of being, blinkers, enslavement to structures. It looks like the beginning of a brand new phase. And what I'll be concentrating on next is pinning down some techniques that will be able to get me along that path and up to Tifereth.